If you would, please be turning in your Bibles to Matthew chapter 26. That will be our text for this morning. But I'd like to first set the stage for what we'll be studying this morning and take us to the events immediately preceding the trial and the crucifixion of Jesus Christ. Jesus and the 12 disciples have just observed the Passover feast in an upper room in Jerusalem. Just a day or two earlier, Jesus had announced that he would be crucified at the Passover. And now he has just instituted the Lord's Supper, indicating to them that the bread and wine they have partaken of are emblems of his body and blood, which will be given for many for the remission of sins. It is during this time that Jesus also announces that one of the 12 disciples would betray him, and he then commands Judas to go do what he has to do and do it quickly. The other disciples are completely unaware of the nature of Judas's mission. They possibly think that he is going out to do some preparing for the Passover or help the poor in some way. After singing a hymn, Jesus and the remaining disciples leave the house where they've been observing the feast and cross over the brook Kidron to the Mount of Olives. It is there that Jesus takes Peter, James, and John into the Garden of Gethsemane to spend the night in prayer. And Jesus, well aware of the horrific events that would be awaiting him in the next few hours, is in agony, praying repeatedly to the Father to let this cup pass from him. Yet each time he qualifies his prayer with the Father's will being more important than his own. And though he has asked the three to watch and pray with him, it seems the events of the previous few days and the foreboding words of their master have taken their emotional toll on the disciples, and they're not able to stay awake. Luke says they are sleeping from sorrow, Luke 22:45. While all this is taking place, Judas has seized the opportunity to follow through on the bargain he has struck with the chief priest to betray Jesus to them for 30 shekels of silver. Jesus, after praying, wakes the disciples for the third time, informing them that the time for him to be betrayed is at hand, which takes us to our text for this morning. We'll be reading Matthew 26:47-57. And while he was still speaking, behold, Judas, one of the 12, came up, accompanied by a great multitude with swords and clubs from the chief priests and elders of the people. Now he who was betraying him gave them a sign, saying, "Whomever I shall kiss, he is the one, seize him." And immediately he went to Jesus and said, "Hail, Rabbi," and kissed him. And Jesus said to him, "Friend, do what you have come for." Then they came and laid hands on Jesus and seized him. And behold, one of those who were with Jesus reached and drew out his sword and struck the slave of the high priest and cut off his ear. Then Jesus said to him, "Put your sword back into its place, for all those who take up the sword shall perish by the sword. Or do you think that I cannot appeal to my Father and he will at once put at my disposal more than 12 legions of angels? How then shall the scriptures be fulfilled that it must happen this way?" At that time Jesus said to the multitudes, "Have you come out with swords and clubs to arrest me as against a robber? Every day I used to sit in the temple teaching and you did not seize me. But all this has taken place that the scriptures of the prophets may be fulfilled." Then all the disciples left him and fled. And those who had seized Jesus led him away to Caiaphas, the high priest, where the scribes and the elders were gathered together. You know, there is an awful lot in this passage we could discuss this morning, but I would like for us to spend our time considering one of the more obscure individuals in this passage and probably in the entire Bible. And that's this individual, this slave of the high priest, who had his ear cut off. I think it's worth noting that all four gospel accounts mention this person and all include the detail that one of Jesus' disciples cut his ear off during this encounter. From John's gospel, we learn that the name of this individual is Malchus, and the disciple who cut off his ear is not surprisingly Peter. And we say not surprisingly because Peter's known for his innate ability to act without thinking, something that many of us can relate to. To me, the most interesting detail regarding this event is given in the Gospel of Luke, and I'm sure this is no surprise to anyone. And it says, a certain one of them struck the slave of the high priest and cut off his right ear, but Jesus answered and said, stop, no more of this. And he touched his ear and healed him. And as I read about this encounter and what happened to Malchus, I can't help but to wonder how the events of that evening influenced this individual who we know so little about. He has come with this great multitude to arrest this man and deliver him up to be crucified. And in the process, he has his ear cut off. You know, and that has to be, it seems to me, an extremely painful injury. I don't know if you've ever hit your ear against something or had somebody box your ear, as they might say. Sometimes I'll wake up in the night and my ear is just killing me. I think it's because my head's so fat and it can't handle the weight. But having your ear cut off must be just a horrible pain to undergo. But rather than having to experience a long and painful recovery and go through the rest of his life with this disfiguring scar, the man he has come to arrest, that he has proven to be an enemy to, reaches out his hand and instantly and miraculously heals him, which somehow has no visible effect on this arresting multitude or as far as we know, Malchus. During the course of his 3-year ministry, Jesus performed many miracles and healed many people. And we are almost always given the reaction of the person who is healed. And it is almost always one of thankfulness and praise and oftentimes a recognition of who Jesus is. But we're not given this information in the case of Malchus. And it makes me wonder, when the sun rose that morning, what did Malchus think? You know, what did he do? Did anything change in his life, his actions, his thinking, his perspective? Did he then recognize who Jesus was, for who he was? Or did he still have the same opinion regarding Jesus as he did the evening before? Did his allegiance change, if even only in his heart? Or did he just go on serving the Jewish high priest as he had done all along? And I'm well aware that these are questions we're not given the answers to. And somebody might say, you know, give it up, Rick. There's no sermon there. Just, you know, let's sing a song and go home. But that's not the way I do things. Maybe that's right. Maybe there isn't anything here. But I really think we're given this detail for a reason. And there is a reason all 4 gospel accounts mention this incident. I don't know why. What I do know is that there are some things that we can reasonably infer from the information we're given, and I think some practical applications that perhaps we can make to our own lives that might help us serve God more perfectly. Well, first thing I would ask is what do we know about this individual Malchus? We basically have one verse in each of the 4 Gospels that mentions him. But there are some other things I think we can determine. But we do know that he was a servant of the high priest. And I think it's only logical to assume that he was there at the high priest's direction. I don't think he would have just on his own gone with his arresting party to arrest Jesus. He was doing his master's bidding, I would presume. That begs the question, did Malchus know for what purpose Jesus was being arrested? I'm not sure, but I think there's a possibility that he did. Here's what we're told in Matthew 26, 3 and 4. Then the chief priest and the elders of the people were gathered together in the court of the high priest named Caiaphas, and they plotted together to seize Jesus by stealth and kill him. Well, here's Malchus, the servant of Caiaphas, the high priest. Was he there listening? Was he privy to this information? We're not told that. He may have been a servant, but the very fact that the high priest sent him out with the arresting party causes me to think that he probably had some authority. He may even have been acting as the high priest's representative. Did he know what he was doing there? That's not conclusive, but I think it's quite possible. I think another thing that's possible is he might have been armed. And while he was still speaking, this is regarding Jesus, behold, Judas, one of the 12, came up, accompanied by a great multitude with swords and clubs from the chief priests and elders of the people. So it doesn't say who was armed, but I think it's quite possible that Malchus may have been armed. We don't know for sure. But one thing I would suggest is that he was at the forefront of this great multitude. And I know one thing we can know conclusively is that he was close enough to Jesus and the disciples for Peter's sword to reach his head, wasn't he? So that would put him out front, I would think. And it seems to me that he may likely have been one of the individuals who actually laid his hands on Jesus. It seems like it's almost inferred in the text. Look at Matthew 26, 50 through 51. Then they came and laid hands on Jesus and seized him. And behold, one of those who were with Jesus reached and drew out his sword and struck the slave of the high priest and cut off his ear. Now, if somebody is assaulting someone you love, who do you go after? The person who's assaulting them. You don't go after the person standing next to them or off in the distance. You go after the person who's the most immediate threat. And it seems logical to reason that Malchus was an immediate threat to Jesus in this case. So he seems to be aggressive in this situation. He seems to be close enough for this to take place. What does all this mean? Well, I think the one thing that we can know is that Malchus was not an innocent bystander here at the arrest of Jesus Christ. He was in the thick of it. You know, and really when you look at what's going on here in Matthew 26 and what the other Gospels teach us, you have two different parties, don't you? You have this great multitude coming to arrest Jesus, and then you have Jesus and the 11 remaining disciples. You have those who are for him and those who are against him. There are no innocent bystanders in this picture. And the point I would make is that, you know, there are no innocent bystanders in this life. I think many people want to see themselves that way. They want to come to, you know, when it comes to Jesus, they choose not to take sides. And it's kind of, you know, you believe what you believe, and I'll believe what I believe, and we'll just all get along. And you know, I've had somebody, you know, that I told them I was Christian. You know, well, that's cool. I'm not sure that's the adjective I would use. I think it can be cool in a sense. But their point was, you know, whatever floats your boat, you know, and, you know, whatever floats my boat, as long as we're all floating together, we're okay. And God has given each of us free will. And we have the choice whether we are going to believe and accept and serve him or not. But what Jesus teaches us is that a choice has to be made. You cannot sit on the fence. There are no innocent bystanders. We know this passage well, I'm sure. He who is not with me is against me, and he who does not gather with me scatters. That's Luke 11, 23. There are no innocent bystanders when it comes to Jesus Christ. Let's use this for the Lord's Supper this morning, a very appropriate passage, but it's Isaiah 53. I'm going to read it this morning, and I want us to read this, and I'm sure we did, but if we're missing the point of this passage, then we're missing where we are in relationship to God. Surely our griefs he himself bore, and our sorrows he carried, yet we ourselves esteemed him stricken, smitten of God, and afflicted. But he was pierced through for our transgression, he was crushed for our iniquities. The chastening for our well-being fell upon him, and by his scourging we are healed. And all of us like sheep have gone astray. Each of us has turned to his own way, but the Lord has caused the iniquity of us all to fall on him. What this passage is teaching is that every one of us is complicit, just as Malchus was, in the crucifixion of Jesus Christ. Whether we see ourselves that way or not, whether we were there or not, But when I look at myself, what I have to realize is that it is my sin that nailed him to the cross. Judas delivered up Jesus to be crucified for 30 shekels of silver. And I think sometimes we're aghast at how callous and selfish he was. But I would suggest that we delivered up Jesus to be crucified for even less than that because of our sin. And we need to take that responsibility when we see ourselves in relationship to Jesus Christ and in relationship to God. Like Malchus, not one of us is an innocent bystander. We are all complicit in the suffering and the crucifixion of Jesus Christ. You know, one question that I think about prior to this encounter: what did Malchus think of Jesus? What was his perspective? And, you know, I'm not going to pretend to know the answer to the question, but I think we know, as is the case with nearly everyone, his perspective was influenced by the people with whom he regularly associated. Would that not stand to reason? Isn't that how it works? You know, we're doing a job over at Warren Wilson College right now, and I think I said this to somebody else, but it's amazing how much all of those students look alike. I've never seen so much conformity among nonconformists. I mean, and I'm not, you know, that's just the way it is. I mean, people would walk into this building and say, you know, people are dressing alike and for the most part and things like that. You know, we are influenced by our associations. We do know that the high priest whom Malchus served saw Jesus as a threat to his power and his political position and his way of life, a threat that needed to be extinguished. Here's what we're told in Matthew chapter, John 11, 47 through 50. Therefore, the chief priests and the Pharisees convened a council and were saying, "What are we going to do? For this man is performing many signs. If we let him go on like this, all men will believe in him, and the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation." And but a certain one of them, Caiaphas, who was high priest that year, said to them, "You know nothing at all, nor do you take into account that it is expedient for you that one man should die for the people and that the whole nation should not perish." Now, we're told later in the text that Caiaphas unwittingly prophesied. His point here is that Jesus should die so we can maintain our status quo. That's the point he's making. This is going to mess up everything. Everyone's going to believe in him, and we're not going to have what we have anymore. I wonder, was Malchus present there at this meeting? You know, we're not told. Obviously his actions at the Mount of Olives demonstrate that he was of the same perspective. At the very least, he was there to arrest Jesus, and he seemed to be very involved in what was going on there. And I would also imagine that being a servant of the high priest was probably a pretty good gig at that time, though I doubt if it was referred to as a gig. This was the most powerful and probably one of the wealthiest Jewish households in all of Jerusalem, the household of the high priest. Think about it. This is about as high as you could get in the Jewish culture in that time. And I imagine there were some great benefits to being a servant there. And one would think that whatever posed as a threat to the high priest would have posed a threat to Malchus himself. I don't know. But that's possible that that's how he saw these things. But he, like I said, he seemed to be an individual, a servant with some kind of authority there. People... And the point really is, people believe all kinds of things regarding the Bible and regarding Jesus for all kinds of reasons. And like the high priest of that day, and even Malchus, their beliefs are not always from the purest of motives. Sometimes what they think about Jesus couldn't be any farther from the truth. And I think many people, whether they realize it or not, see people as a threat to their current way of life. I know I did. You know, before I became a Christian, there were things I was involved in that I did not want to give up. And I knew enough about Jesus and enough about the Bible to know that if I became a disciple of Jesus Christ, that I was going to have to change my way of life. And there was a period in my life where I was not ready to do that. And there's a very real sense in where I saw Christianity, I saw the teaching of Jesus Christ as a threat to my way of life. I've had professors in college. I don't know why they had the perspective they had, but my underlying feeling is that if they believed in the Bible and believed in Jesus Christ, they would have to change so many things in their life or change their perspective on things, and they were not willing to do that. So the easiest thing to do is attack the Bible and attack Jesus and dismiss it. And these professors are teaching this in our colleges. But it's not just professors. You know, are we believing what we believe out of pure motives, out of a pure agenda? Or are we believing it just because we've been taught it, whether by our parents or by our professors or because our friends believe it or because it's taught at our church? Or have we investigated who Jesus is for ourselves? Have we studied? Have we taken the time to consider these things and truly investigate? You know, what Satan wants us to see as a threat to our way of life is really the solution to the problem of sin when it comes to Jesus Christ. He wants us to see it as a threat, and he wants to steer us away from it. You know, what someone else believes or teaches about Jesus may very well have nothing whatsoever to do with who he really is. And many people live their lives simply accepting what they're taught or what they're told, and perhaps Malchus was in that group. He just went along with what everybody else was saying about Jesus. And that's why he was there to arrest him. But the only way we will ever get to truly know who Jesus is by seeing him for ourselves, and we only know that through his word. And a couple passages I'm sure most of us are extremely familiar with. John 20:30-31. Many other signs therefore Jesus also performed in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book. But these have been written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in his name. And what John is saying, I've written these things so you can read them. And you can see evidence that Jesus is who he claims to be, and believe in him, and believing have life in his name. 2 Peter 1:2-3, another passage I thought of as I was just putting this together. Grace and peace be multiplied to you in the knowledge of God and of Jesus our Lord, seeing that his divine power has granted us everything pertaining to life and godliness through the true knowledge of him who called us to his own glory and excellence. Where do we get that true knowledge? Where do we get that knowledge that is mentioned here in 2 Peter? We get it through his word. And that's the only way we're going to get it, in an unbiased approach, free from agenda. You know, and we try to do that here. You know, you should not accept what someone tells you about Jesus just because they say it, and that includes myself or Joe or Les or whoever else happens to be teaching. We need to get to the word ourselves. And that, you know, that's a lesson we teach over and over again, but I think it needs to be taught over and over again, because so many people seem to just accept what they're taught, and that's enough. You know, what's interesting here is that Malchus did actually get to see Jesus for himself that evening. And I'd like to spend the rest of this lesson quickly noting what Malchus saw and what we might learn from that. If you read the description of the arresting party, the thing that is quite clear is that these men that were coming to arrest Jesus were expecting a fight. And I never really considered that until I began preparing for this lesson. And while he was still speaking, behold, Judas, one of the 12, came up accompanied by a great multitude with swords and clubs from the chief priests and elders of the people. A great multitude versus Jesus and the 11 disciples. I mean, that's quite a contrast, isn't it? Notice what's said in John here. Judas then, having received the Roman cohort and officers from the chief priests and the Pharisees, came there with lanterns and torches and weapons. From my research, it appears that a Roman cohort was 600 men. That kind of puts a number on that great multitude, doesn't it? Now, whether it was an entire cohort, we're not told, but it says a Roman cohort. And that doesn't count those from the chief priests and the Pharisees. So you've got this humongous multitude coming to the Mount of Olives to arrest this man and 11 disciples. Or whether they were there to arrest the 11 disciples is not clear. You know, it seems a little bit overkill to me. And part of me wonders, you know, we've already seen that it's clear that the chief priests and the Pharisees recognize that Jesus was doing many signs. And I wonder if they were possibly even expecting some kind of supernatural resistance, which is, you know, why would they even go against him if they thought that might be the case? Of course, what did they attribute his signs to? Satan. So I think that's possible, or maybe they just thought more disciples were going to be there. But it seems to me they've got a lot of people coming against Jesus. And that kind of sets up what we're going to see here in the next little section. So here Malchus is with Judas and this great multitude coming to arrest Jesus. And here's what we're told takes place in John chapter 18 and 4 through 6. Jesus, therefore, knowing all the things that were coming upon him, went forth and said to them, "Whom do ye seek?" They answered him, "Jesus the Nazarene." He said to them, "I am he." And Judas also, who was betraying him, was standing with them. When therefore he said to them, "I am he," they drew back and fell to the ground. You know, I think we've recognized here before, and I, you know, perhaps you know this or not, that the he here in the "I am he" is interpolated. That means it's added by translators. And what Jesus literally says here is, "I am." The very thing that God told Moses at the burning bush when Moses said, "Whom shall I tell the children of Israel has sent me?" And God said, "I am." This is the very thing Jesus told the Pharisees in John chapter 8, 58, which caused them to pick up stones to throw at him because they understood what he was claiming. He was claiming to be God. Jesus is announcing to this multitude who he is here, I believe. But I think he does more than announces it. I think he demonstrates it, because at the very power of his words, those who were seeking to arrest him fell back to the ground. It says all of them, the entire multitude. Now, either they recognized that as God's power, or they chose to ignore it. Seems to me they chose to ignore it. They're so dumbfounded, Jesus has to reinitiate the conversation. In the next verse, he says, "Whom do you seek?" You know, and I think, you know, they might have said it a little quieter that time. I'm not sure. But they ignored it. And that's the thing that is just so striking to me, that here they come to arrest this man, and there is a clear demonstration of the power of God that knocks them back to the ground, and they go forward with it. Well, you know, I think there's a parallel for us. That there is evidence of the power of God all around us. It's on every hand. Romans 1:20 says this, "For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, so that they are without excuse." Those who don't accept it from being from God, says Paul says here in Romans, they are without excuse. Psalm 19 and verse 1, "The heavens are telling of the glory of God, and their expanse is declaring the work of his hands." The question for you and me is, how do we choose to respond to this overwhelming evidence? Do we dismiss it as a fluke or a coincidence? Or do we just choose to ignore it? Seems to me a lot of people today choose to ignore it. Less occasionally sings a song at our musical get-togethers by a fellow named David Wilcox. It's called "Big Mistake." And contrary to popular belief, it's not about the person who you voted for in the last election. But that was a joke that didn't work. But let's go on to this. I'm not going to be able to read that from there. But let's go ahead and read this quickly. And this is what David, these are a couple of verses out of that song. And it says, I love this song, by the way. It says, "They taught us kids in school, between the recess breaks, that the universe just sort of fell together like a big mistake. It started with a bang that sent the pieces flying, and then it cooled and twirled into dinosaurs and dandelions." Here's another verse, not necessarily in order. "Now back in science class, through the looking glass, we were magnifying little ancestors of our ancient past. Watch them break a couple chromosomes, wait a zillion years or so, and get an ostrich, a jellyfish, a kangaroo, and a Romeo. It was a big mistake to have eyes that see, to have love like this inside of me, to have lips that smile as I swim your kiss, to have minds that will forever, or remember, I think the point is, every part of this. I love that song. And the point the author is obviously making here is it is ludicrous to suggest that this world and everything in it and all we see and all we feel and all we experience is the product of an accident. And that's what evolution teaches, that it was just an accident, that this happened to be here at this time, and there was this bang, and it was, and here we are, thinking and breathing and loving and living and seeing all this around us and being fed off trees and plants and things such as that. It was just an accident. It was a big mistake. It's ludicrous to believe that when you really put it in perspective. And that's what Paul is saying in Romans. You're without excuse if you don't accept this as the proof of God's existence and his power. You're without excuse. It seems to me those men that came to arrest Jesus were without excuse when they followed through on what they did. He demonstrated through his word and through his power who he was so clearly and definitively, and they went through with it. But he does the same with us. Through everything he has made and everything he has done, it was not a big mistake. You know, something else Malchus witnessed that evening, I think, was the sacrificial love of Jesus Christ. Note what Jesus said to Peter after he had cut off Malchus's ear. He said, "Then Jesus said to him, 'Put your sword back into its place, for all those who take up the sword shall perish by the sword. Or do you think that I cannot appeal to my Father, and he will at once put at my disposal more than 12 legions of angels?'" You think a Roman cohort's a lot. I think legions is in the thousands, if I recall. Jesus said, at my word, God can send 12 legions of angels here to defend me. And this was obviously said in the presence and hearing of the multitude. Now, whether Jesus said this, this is obviously after Malchus' ear was cut off. If he said it before he healed his ear, I think Malchus would have been a little distracted and may not have heard it. But if he said it after he healed his ear, he possibly would have heard it. But the multitude, it was said in the presence of that multitude. And this statement, along with the power that Jesus had just demonstrated when they fell to the ground, clearly shows that this is something that Jesus did not have to go through with. We know that. But it's demonstrated here, even to this crowd. With just one word, he could have stopped it right then and there. It would have been that simple. But he had prayed earlier, "Not my will, but thy will be done." And instead, note what he says in John 18 and 8. This is when he says, "Whom do you seek?" You know, reinitiating the conversation. They said, "Jesus of Nazareth," again. And Jesus answered, "I told you that I am he. If therefore you seek me, let these go their way." And I'm not sure if that's a request or a command. You know, that's one of the things I wonder. Basically, he's telling them, let the disciples go, and they certainly did. And he could have made them do it, and maybe he did in that particular case. But he willingly gave himself over to this multitude, knowing full well that it was going to lead to his crucifixion on the cross, not to mention the brutal scourging he was going to undergo in the hours before that. And he didn't only do it for the sake of those 11 disciples, but he also did it for you and me because of his immense love for us. So I think Malchus witnessed the sacrificial love of Jesus Christ even there at that point. I think one other thing, I didn't want to go there yet, so I think one other thing he also saw was the compassion of Jesus Christ. You know, when you think about what took place that evening, here Malchus comes with his great multitude that are coming to arrest Jesus to ultimately have him crucified. And Peter cuts off Malchus's ear. Jesus could have easily allowed Malchus to suffer that evening. It seems that certainly something he deserved. But Jesus had compassion on him and healed him, this person who had clearly proven to be his enemy. That's quite amazing in itself right there, and that showed the nature of Christ to, I believe, Malchus and that multitude. But I think what we really need to see there is that this is how God sees each of us. Though we have sinned against him and hurt him, and hurt ourselves in doing so, he doesn't want us to suffer. He doesn't want to punish us. He doesn't want retribution. He only wants to heal us and make us complete if we will only humble ourselves and trust in him. And one passage that came to mind as I was studying this is 1 Peter 5:6-7. Humble yourselves, therefore, under the mighty hand of God, that he may exalt you at the proper time, casting all your anxiety upon him, because he cares for you. And if there's one thing you get out of this lesson today, it's that God cares for you. He's not vengeful. He's not spiteful. He's not arrogant. He does not want retribution. He wants to heal your hurt, just as Jesus healed Malchus' hurt there at the Mount of Olives. You know, we've talked about all this with the initial question, what did Malchus think? You know, how did he respond when the sun rose the next morning? I doubt he slept. And this is, I think, in the middle of the night. You know, the question still remains unanswered, doesn't it? We don't know. I'd like to think that Malchus became a disciple of Jesus Christ after what he went through. You know, was he still arresting Jesus after he got his ear healed, or did he walk off to the fringes and kind of sit there and say, wow, you know, what am I doing here? We're not told any of that. And, you know, we won't know unless we have an opportunity to talk to someone who knows someday. But the more important question, it seems to me, is what do I think of Jesus Christ? Jesus Christ, who I was complicit in nailing to the cross. Jesus Christ, who I have every opportunity to learn about and know about through his word. Jesus Christ, who has given me all the evidence I need to believe in him. I'm without excuse. God has done everything he can to teach us about himself through what he has created and through his word. And if we do not take that opportunity, then we are without excuse, we're told. Jesus Christ, who willingly offered himself to be crucified for my sins, and Jesus Christ, who will heal me and make me whole if I will only allow him. What do I think of Jesus Christ? That's the question that we all need to be asking, and really on a daily basis. You know, those of us who are Christians here, you know, what if Malchus was healed, and then he just went on with his life the way it was? We wouldn't think very much of Malchus, would we? But we, you know, we have to see ourselves as being healed. What if we are not seeing Christ as we should see him? What if we're living lives of sin? You know, what if we're betraying him daily by sinning and nailing him afresh to the cross? We can't be that way. We shouldn't think much of ourselves if we're doing that. The wonderful thing is that God has compassion, and we can repent and return to him and have our sins forgiven. If you are a Christian and you need to do that at this time, or if you've never given yourself to Jesus Christ, he teaches that those who believe and are baptized shall be saved. If you'd like to study these things further, we'd be glad to sit down with you. But if you are open to the invitation at this time, you may come forward while we stand and sing the song of invitation.